I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas? We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone.
Welcome to Post-Carbon Radio, where we cover the climate crisis from a range of perspectives centered on Northern California. Climate change is the ultimate interrelated issue, so we include news and perspectives on clean and dirty energy, the economy, social justice, and even war and peace. We want to both inform and inspire you by connecting you to people, movements, and new ideas about climate change from around the world and right here in West Marin. And Karen is going to start us off with a report from the U.S. Social Forum.
Sure. And then we will be bringing on three special guests today, so stand by for that. I wanted listeners to know, last time we introduced the climate calendar, and one of the items on the climate calendar I listed was the U.S. Social Forum, and another item I listed was flood the system. And at that time, I didn't know what it was. But I'm happy to report, because I attended the U.S. Social Forum in San Jose a couple weeks ago, that I found out all about it. And so I'm mainly going to be telling you about Flood the System and upcoming actions this fall and into next year. Flood the System is a series of escalating actions that's being planned by a network called Rising Tide North America. They're calling this Confronting the Root Causes of Climate Change. Rising Tide was formed in the Netherlands in 2000 by environmental and social justice activists attending the UN Conference of the Parties Climate Talks, which is the subject of much of our conversation today. Rising Tide now spans four continents with activists in North and South America, the UK, Ecuador, and Australia. The North American network was founded in spring 2006, and they've held continental gatherings for the North American continent the last two years. More recently, you may have heard them in the news. They carried out actions in Seattle against Arctic drilling and in Denton, Texas, in defense of a ban on fracking that residents there recently enacted. They are now calling in this Flood the System call for actions to, quote, shut down the economic and political systems threatening our survival. So we're going to talk about a whole range of perspectives today, from sort of the very orderly Conference of the Parties UN process to these sorts of much more outside of the system perspectives and actions. So I just want people to know that that's what's going on with Rising Tide and this series of actions called Flood the System. They're just starting to form what are called flood councils, which if you've ever been involved in affinity group type organizing, it's like a spokes council. This is very much a movement-building focus. It's very inclusive, and the Bay Area Flood Council is not quite meeting yet. I'm sure we'll be hearing from our guests today more about various types of organizing that are going on around this fall's conference. So if you want to know more about Flood the System, you can sign up at floodthesystem.net and calendar September 29th for the first big action. And as a reminder, we'll be doing the second climate calendar at the end of this hour. So if you want to get a piece of paper and pencil or a smartphone or whatever you use ready to make those announcements. We will be reading the climate calendar at the end of the hour. And finally, just as a reminder, we also have started an email you can use to give us feedback for the show or ideas, and that's postcarbon@earthlink.net. So now we'd like to welcome our guests for today.
Yeah, both guests are veteran observers of the UN climate negotiations. And on the telephone in San Francisco, we have Victor Minotti, Executive Director of the International Forum on Globalization, a North-South think tank with prominent activist board members. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Victor.
Good day, Wes Marin.
All right. And with us, we also have Claire Greensfelder. She's the co-founder of Women's Global Call for Climate Justice. And on the road to Paris, 6 months, six themes, six actions. She is also senior advisor on climate and energy for Women in Europe for a Common Future. And is that in addition to the Women's Environment and Development Organization, or is that part of WIDO?
They're two different groups,
okay.
Both of whom I'm working with in order to implement the Women's Global Call, which I'll talk about on the radio program today.
Wonderful. Well, welcome, Claire, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
In the interest of transparency, I should say that I am a board treasurer of the International Forum on Globalization, but today I have my radio journalist hat on, and we're going to talk about the UN negotiations, especially what happened in Bonn, because Victor and Claire were both there. And so let's start off with that. Give our listeners a rundown on what happened in Bonn and what was its purpose and what can we expect in Paris leading up to the COP21 Conference of the Parties in Paris in December. Who would like to start?
Claire, why don't you? You've been closer to the action with the.
Sure. Just for the listeners, as many of the listeners of Bing's programs know, Bing and Karen, that there's been an ongoing series of meetings in order to implement the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was initially agreed to in Rio at the Big Earth Summit in 1992. And when you think about that, we're a long way from Rio. I mean, that was the 1992 Earth Summit, the first conference of the parties, which means the conference of the governments. And you'll hear a lot about that this year if you're following the climate meetings. COP21 actually stands for not the 21st policeman on the beat, but it stands for the 21st conference of the parties or nations who agreed to be part of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which includes the United States, which was actually agreed to by the first George Bush, surprising but true. However, quickly, by the third Conference of the Parties, which the Kyoto Protocol was established in 1997, in Kyoto, the U.S. had opted out and did not approve the agreement that was put in Kyoto, although President Clinton did sign it, actually, but the Senate never ratified it. And part of what we've been working on then for the last, it was 1997, what would this be, for the last 18 years, as we come upon COP21 in Paris this December, is getting adequate agreements out of governments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions such that we can move away from runaway and potentially, well, even more catastrophic climate change, since we're already seeing the effects. And one of the issues that is ongoing in the negotiations is that for many years the agreement was that we were trying to hold global climate temperature rise to 2.0 degrees centigrade. And now the general science from the last Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, a UN scientist panel that has 1,500 climate scientists from around the world, is now, and many others are recommending, that 2.0 is not enough, and we have to bring the limited threshold down to 1.5 degrees. Many of you have also heard the number 350. That stands for the parts per million in the atmosphere that's acceptable for us to continue, and that we're already past 350 parts per million of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, so that number has to come down too. So basically, part of the push is there's twofold part of the push to get the science, the climate emissions, and the agreements to get the emissions of the atmosphere down that meets the science, and we're not there yet. we are not there yet from the commitments from governments in terms of reduction of carbon emissions. And the second part is financing for development in developing countries to help them transition to safe energy technologies so that there are not new fossil fuel-driven energies in other countries. And we're not there yet either. There's been a call for a $100 billion green climate fund, $100 billion a year for 20 years, to make this happen, which now, and I'll finish up with this, many economists are saying that's not enough. It's going to be more like $450 billion a year. And just for comparison, the U.S. military budget is $550 billion a year. So it's doable. It's just the money isn't there. To this date, the there's only been $10 billion pledged to this fund that's supposed to have $100 billion in it to launch, hopefully next year. So we're not there yet. The U.S. has pledged $3 billion through Obama, and as some of you may know, there's a $500 million appropriation running through the Senate committees this right now in an attempt to get a serious commitment of money to for Obama to bring to Paris. So here in the U.S., we haven't made the financial commitment that we should make, given that 40% of the historical emissions are ours. Perhaps we should be paying for 40% of that $100 or $450 billion per year. So there's still struggle over the climate fund, over what the actual emissions will be, over what the regime will be. And then finally, there's something called an INDC, which is an intended national, I wish I could what the D stands for. Victor, can you remind me what is that? The INDC is basically your national commitment for climate greenhouse gas reductions. It's now a voluntary system. The old Kyoto Protocol had a mandatory system, and every country is supposed to submit their INDC in September, and there'll be a meeting in Morocco in October to review these, and that is going to be a critical meeting to prepare for December. If we don't have adequate commitments from governments, we're not there. So that's the Bond report, and I'll pass to Victor for his end of it. When we're done with that, I'll come back to, since we're not getting the movement we need from governments and agreements we need, what's going to be happening in the streets and publicly between now and December, which is where the action is going to be that I'm going to be focusing on. So back to Victor.
Great. And just I'm going to take a moment to remind our listeners, this is KWMR, and you're listening to Post Carbon Radio. We're talking with Claire Greensfelder, who wears many hats around climate and development, and particularly women's involvement in climate change. We'll list her affiliations, her numerous affiliations, at the end of the show. And Victor Minotti, who's with the International Forum on Globalization. And Victor, you were just going to chime in on Claire's excellent summary of what's been happening recently in the climate negotiations.
That was an excellent summary. Thank you, Claire. Like Claire, the two of us have been involved in this climate convention for literally a few decades. You might wonder what makes people continue to get engaged, keep engaged. I actually haven't been so engaged lately, except for I did go to this past Bonn session to check in before Paris, which is this December. Claire gave a good overview back from Rio 92 when Papa Bush signed on to this. So what is our President Obama expected to do is what a lot of people are wondering right now. There is this INDC, it's called the Intentional Nationally Determined Contribution, which is a pledge to cut carbon emissions. And which will be the basis of the Paris deal. So for International Forum on Globalization, that's the priority for us. We've been trying to figure out who are the leaders of this fossil fuels industry that are stopping the solutions and keeping us from really making the commitments nationally and multilaterally that we need to address this crisis. And so when we followed the numbers, the money of the fossil fuels companies and the carbon, which, you know, the Koch brothers that we found spent more than all the other oil companies, Exxon, Chevron, Conoco. A lot of people don't know that, but these two billionaires are bigger than big oil. They are the brains and the pocketbooks of big oil. And if you follow the debate, it's less and less Exxon and Chevron who are denying or even running away from carbon taxes. They seem to say they've been figuring in costs of carbon already for a number of years. But the Kochs are holding out and have built this movement nationally to block any U.S. action and therefore any U.N. action. And so we were there in Bonn to call that out and to release our new report on why Koch is really doing this. So that is something that isn't often heard at the international level. And I think even at the U.S. level, the research that we're putting out is still new news to a lot of people on the front lines doing tar sands work. I'd say picking up within the progressive community and certainly other areas of progressive communities. Well, in Wisconsin, for instance, labor and workers certainly know about the Koch brothers because of Scott Walker, and increasingly women's rights organizations do as well, because it's a lot of Koch-funded extremist candidates and officials who are shutting down the clinics and other places where women's reproductive rights are made available, and really important services. Koch is also involved in the voting rights rollback, so their role in the climate crisis, I think, is becoming more slowly and better known. And what we need for Paris is some way to bring together that collective power of those constituencies and get the president to make a bigger commitment than what he has on the table. So, where we are right now, pre-Paris, still 6 months out, 5 months out and counting, the U.S. has put something on the table, and the climate movement does not have the political power right now to increase the ambition of that pledge and make it ecologically adequate or socially just to align with other countries' pledges and commitments. And so, Rising Tide and other actions are looking at this pathway to Paris 350. Planning meetings are going on, and groups are planning on turning up the temperature this summer and this fall, and to make sure that that governments do the deal to protect the planet as they need to here. But it's up to us to mobilize and to make it happen. We have this really tricky situation now where, the president pretty much has his hands tied because of Congress, and Koch now controlling Congress. We do need to look to the next elections to really replace these guys. But in the meantime, there is, an interesting conversation beginning about what we can do between now and Paris to increase the ambition even more. At least that's something that IFG is beginning to do with others, through a U.S. Climate Action Network and some of the other organizing spaces where people are thinking about Paris, and they're thinking, what can we really do to, make it meaningful and not produce another sort of Copenhagen situation? If its expectations need to be managed from the beginning, which it sounds like they do, then let's not get fooled like a lot of us did in Copenhagen, but going with our eyes open. And if there is something more possible, I think that's what's really what the conversation is or needs to be about. How do we change the calculus and make something or be ready if and when disaster happens to move with some serious national action that's much more ambitious and much more urgent and much more in line with what the scientists are saying.
Thank you, Victor. It's so important that we move Congress, because whatever they passed, whatever treaty is passed, Congress must approve, as I understand it. And the U.S. and China had a deal, and I heard that it subverts the climate talks because they're not going to be binding. Do you want to hang in on that?
Put out something. You could see Walden Bellow, focus on the Global South, used to live in the Bay Area and run Food First for a number of years also, but back in the Philippines and Bangkok, where his group operates out of, you could see a very good breakdown of that U.S.-China deal, which he criticizes because of the point being the emissions commitments that really sort of lets them out. So one could say that the U.S. has turned China in a way and aligned interests that they both share as the two biggest polluters on the planet of not making any real commitments to cut their carbon. So, you know, both should rightly be criticized for if that's the direction they're going to go, or the U.S. has tried to take China, then it just shows you how much more pressure we have to put on our own government so that they don't take China down this path, or that we're able to support what Chinese activists are calling for their government to do. At least many of the ones we know that they need urgent cuts just as the U.S. does.
Well, and let me chime in on this, which is, this is Claire speaking, who also, if we do total disclosure, of course, I've been a colleague and actually worked with the IFG off and on over the last 20 years. So we're all part of the same Bay Area activist family. And this is one of the critical things that our listeners and others can do, is that here we are as the U.S. You hear a lot of folks talking about China, and it's true. China is the leading world emitter now. But up until a few years ago, it was the U.S., and in terms of parts per million per capita, the U.S., still the average per capita emissions from someone here in the U.S. is around 18 to 20 tons per person per year, whereas in China it was like 4 to 6. It may be growing, but when you think about the only reason their emissions are so high is that the sheer numbers of the people that are there. But when you hear a lot of the struggle in these international meetings has been the relative percentage contributions, in the sense that here you have the U.S., who's been on what the rest of the world would say a long-term carbon party, where we've increased the wealth of our country, of the individual people in our country, for the last 50 years and longer, based on access to cheap fossil fuel. And now that other countries are accessing this even not so cheap fossil fuel anymore, that they want to also bring their people out of poverty into development, we have a tremendous opportunity to use the resources of the United States. I will once again point to the military budget to actually help speed and implement a post-carbon revolution of solar and wind and wave energy and energy efficiency and conservation around the world. That's not where our money is going. I mean, if you think about Obama's reduced to asking for $500 million when in 1 year, and that's a struggle, that's less than 1% of our global military budget annually.
I'm glad you said that, Claire, because when you named that number, we had just been talking about tens of billions of dollars and hundreds of billions of dollars globally. So half a billion is really a drop in the bucket, but we're struggling for it. That's what I'm hearing from you.
We're struggling for it, and we're fighting for it. The Washington groups are certainly fighting for it. But I feel part of it is that partly because of the media, partly because we're still, you know, organizing. But the organizing, you know, 10 years ago, what was it, 10 years ago? Maybe 6 years ago, in the preparations for Copenhagen, we would have monthly meetings, and you could get all the activists who were focused on Copenhagen around one conference table, mm-hmm. albeit a large one, but 30, maybe 40 people in our monthly meetings that we were having. Now there's 10,000 people showing up in a demonstration in Oakland. There's actions in Richmond. There's actions at Chevron. There's the Bay Area refinery walks. There's meetings every day. The Climate Justice Power Conference that's going to be taking place in Richmond. There's the Our Power Conference. It's the growth in awareness and activism is critical, but we have to be able to deliver the goods, which is the change in how much our government is going to put forward. And it also means changing the people who are making the decisions in our government. The elections in 2016 are going to be critical. As long as we can't manifest an agreement in the Senate with a majority, we can't get the appropriations that we need to truly do our part. So for me, one of the things that I'm focusing on this year that had been mentioned by you is this women's global organizing. We're launching 12 women's networks from around the world after evaluating the results of the Lima meeting in last December, the COP20. We felt that, yes, we knew every place that the government negotiations had resulted, the state of the negotiations, if you will. And we've made strategies and plans to keep working on the inside, to push harder for better carbon emissions, to push harder for better finance, to push harder for safe and renewable technologies and no funding for dangerous ones like geoengineering or nuclear. And we keep clean coal and all the ones that really aren't clean. But at the same time, we recognize while we have to be vigilant and keep organizing on the inside, and also for gender equality and women's participation in all decision-making, a lot of these decision-making bodies do not have adequate participation of women, who are often the most heavily impacted in local and rural communities, and yet have a lot to contribute to solutions. So it's a whole range of reasons and things that we're working on in the climate negotiations. Having said that, we also realize that we need more action, we need more heat, we need more noise at the local level. So a group of networks from around the world, the All India Women's Conference, based in Delhi with 1,000 local chapters, the Women's Environment Project of Nigeria, the Association de Femmes Autochtones de Chad, a women's indigenous group from Chad, the Asian Pacific Forum on Women in Law and Development, Development Alternatives for Women in a New Era, Dawn from the Global South, Diva for Equality, Women's and Generation and Gender Equality Group from Mexico, Women's Environment Development Organization from the U.S., Women in Europe for Common Future, the Khan Foundation from Bangladesh. We have women's networks from all over the world who are launching tomorrow, July 14th, on Bastille Day, Women to the Barricades. I love the expression of, what was it, flood the system?
Yes.
I think that's a great one. Although we're calling it, collectively we agreed on Women's Global Call for Climate Justice. We also have sort of a nickname, which is Women to the Barricades. And essentially what we've called for is 6 months, six actions on six themes leading up to Paris. Not to wait to Paris to get what we want, but to make noise all over the world. And we'll be launching the call tomorrow. And we agreed on the six themes. And then locally people can decide. You know, in India they felt that it'd be easier to do air, earth, water, fire as opposed to the themes. But and in other countries they're switching the themes based on actions they're doing locally. But essentially our six themes are: July will be energy, August economy, September solutions, October survival, November power, and December climate justice. And just to say that the September solutions, there is a global call for actions on solutions on the last weekend of September around the world. I can send you a link for that that you can put up on the website for the radio station. So we're joining in with the global call for solutions in September. We picked October for Survival Month because there's a global call for actions on food and agriculture on World Food Day, which is October 16th. So again, the September, that third weekend, there'll be a number of actions, last weekend actually, and then also on, I think I was going to mention that on Monday or Tuesday, September 29th, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network has chosen a day to do an action there, and I think you have an announcement for a organizing call they're having. I'll also give you information on how women can join the Women's Global Call, which will be for six actions. A similar idea of flood the system, too. Okay. Do as much as you can between now and December to get the word out, to pressure governments, to everywhere from local governments to national governments, to do more and do better and demand that our national governments do more. Because the last thing I'll say is the numbers that are coming forward now from the INDCs, it's not enough. It's just not enough. And they plus they have to be implemented. It's one thing to make a pledge, and no one has met their pledges from Kyoto. So in order to make sure they make those pledges and commit them and keep them, we're building a global movement of actions around the world that we don't think it's going to stop in December. We think it's going to have to go on for 2016 and beyond to ensure that we really get what we need.
Yes, and I can say for certain that the Flood the System folks at Rising Tide are also looking to well beyond this next UN meeting. And I think that's a sign of progress, along with the 10,000 people instead of a room full that you mentioned. And Claire, we should give you thanks and gratitude for organizing those Road to Copenhagen meetings back in 2009. We are going to take a momentary break to thank some of our underwriters. And when we come back, we've been joined in the studio by the former co-host of Post Carbon Radio, Bernie Stephan, who's here to bring another perspective to this already very rich conversation. And those of you who've been listening to the rich list of organizations and events and actions and networks, we will try to go over that again. And to repeat, we will be doing a calendar at the end of the hour. So get your pencils. And Claire and Victor, of course, we're going to be looking for websites from you. This is KWMR, and we're on Post Carbon Radio, and we have more Post Carbon Radio hosts in the studio than we've ever had before. Bing is here. I'm your Bing Gong. I'm your co-host, Cara Nice, and we're graced to have Bernie Stephan. Is that correct?
Yes.
And let me bring up your mic so you can say your own name. Welcome, Bernie. Welcome back.
Hi, Karen, and hi, Bing. It's nice to be back. I'm excited to have been invited, so I have a lot of thoughts, and I love sharing them.
Well, please do. I know you have a whole different perspective on what's going on.
Well, Bing, you and I started off with you coming back from IFG meetings and stuff, and one of the things we talked a lot about were false solutions. And nowadays, when I hear the word solution, I immediately put false in front of it because, you know, it's direction we need, it's framework we need, and I see a lot of people wanting to act and urgent, seeing the urgency, but everybody's going every which way. And many people still have faith that the current system, which is a nation, which is our industrial economy, which is capitalism, which is globalization, and want to change the globalization model or make it work better. I've come to the belief that there's no way we can make a nation capitalist industrial system like we have solve this problem. Because, you know, the climate change is not the end problem. There are root problems that are common to it and all of the other problems. Climate change is just the latest and greatest and probably the most intense symptom that we see. So it's engaged everybody. But when you, like, chase after keeping CO2 levels below 350 when they're at 400, and I know you talked about that, I think you're not going deep enough. So I come from that perspective of let's reframe the problem, because until we get our minds kind of aligned, I see everybody working at cross purposes. And it's frustrating to me because there's so much energy, and I'd like to see it focused diving deeper rather than trying to fix the system. Because anything, for example, that we say the Congress needs to be fixed, well, if there are more Democrats in it, would we all of a sudden be working towards a sustainable culture? I don't think so. I don't think it matters who's in the seats. I think it's the system overall and the set of systems that we've all grown up with. And so that's extremely difficult to change. But one of the other things I keep seeing is we've outsourced everything. You know, we have such power because of cheap energy. We know that the fossil energy thing allowed us all to be very powerful people, and that means we can hire experts. Everything is specialized, centralized, standardized, so that these people bring us huge wealth and privilege. And so it's easy to point to all of those people that we've outsourced that function that we might be doing for ourselves as not doing it correctly. So it's easy to say the 1% is the problem. It's easy to say the industrial fossil fuel industry is the problem. The spills are the problem. The blowing up tanks are the problem.
How about China?
But the problem is me. I and the other 98%, us 99%, we are the ones that is enabling fracking, not because we haven't got legislators to outlaw it, because we demand the energy. We are going to get the pipeline because renewables aren't renewable. They're extendables of the oil age. And everyone wants this to go on as long as possible. So as we blame other people, let's really reframe this as we who demand all of this energy and power, we're the problem.
Well, Bernie, this is Claire. I totally agree with you. I think there are some things where individually we're the problem, in some cases collectively. And by suggesting that we focus on the Senate, I'm not saying that's the be-all, end-all. In fact, one of the reasons that the month that we have one of our themes being economy is, we're adopting the slogan, which is familiar, system change, not climate change. And with the recognition, as Naomi Klein has said in her book, this changes everything, as the Pope is even implying in some of his statements lately, that the current economic system is not going to allow us to make the kind of radical changes we need. Having said that, not everyone can enter at that place. So we, you have to organize at all levels, bringing people in where they are, but then also focusing on what economically is really needed. And it was very interesting. Last week, I was at UC Irvine presenting the Conversations with the Earth, Indigenous Voices on Climate Change exhibit, which I also work with and have been for the last 6 years. And it's at the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday Compassion Summit and Sustainability Fair, and there was a very articulate scientist from Scripps, Dr. Ramanathan, who posted in an interesting way about this $450 billion. He's where I heard the $450 billion number as what's really needed per year. And the way he posed it, which was very interesting, is that the top 1 billion people on the planet, it's not exactly the 1%, it's obviously more than 1%, but if the top 1 billion economically in the planet each it cost us each $450 a year, that would solve it. And it was an interesting way to look at it, instead of saying this country or that country or Annex 1 or Annex 2, but that if you look at the top 1 billion people in the world, could solve this problem with the tune of $450 each a year, which is a... And partly, how do we do that? How do we get a global buy-in to the fact that we can actually have the financial resources to do what's needed? And this is what takes pressure. This is the thing that takes system change. But we have to try and make it all happen at once, which is hard. And we have to stop the as much as we can the immediate incursion of more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So we have to do both at once. And I think one provides a pathway to the other. And in different places, the different organizing strategies will go at different times. But you're absolutely right to raise it as an issue. At some point, not right now in this conversation, but before the hour's over, Karin, also, and being I'd like to go over what's going on in Paris and the organizing that's going there, a lot with this system change theme in mind, what's going to be happening in Paris and around the world at the grassroots level in December.
So. I'd like to give Victor an opportunity to weigh in.
Thanks, Bing. Well, there's a lot of subjects now. Is there anything particular? About 22.
Well, we're looking for solutions. What do you see?
Well, I guess I see a different theory of change in a way, which I think is one thing you wanted to get to. Like, how do you actually, save the planet in this case? In this case, I think it's not a case where... The dynamic is, we're all the problem. I think you all know, certainly the Rising Tide organizers know, indigenous peoples know, that there are people doing a lot of devious deeds and spending a lot of money to get the fossil fuels out of the ground still. And, launching billions of dollars in political spending to make sure that the pipelines go through and to run over grassroots communities to allow this infrastructure to expand. So, everybody's got to be part of the solution, but some of us are definitely creating more of the problem and, in fact, intentionally exacerbating the crisis. I mean, I think that it's a cartoon of what the Koch brothers sit around and do all the time is how to roll back regulations on carbon and pricing. And that's what I think what is so epic about the organizing opportunity. Faced with focusing on the money of the fossil fuels industry, which is the driver of the climate crisis, is when you get to it, it turns out to be the world's two wealthiest individuals. And to deal with them, you got to deal with all the systemic issues in some way. The money in politics, the externalization of ecological costs are, two of probably the most fundamental things that need to happen if you're going to, counter their power in some way. You have to take on at least those elements of the system and a lot more than, which could be another conversation of an hour. Koch playing the role of the moral defense of capitalism today in the most extreme form that they're advocating right now, that definitely needs to be challenged. And I don't see how one can challenge it without addressing these issues of capitalism and overconsumption and manipulation of political processes by the 1%.
I think Bernie has a little response he'd like to bring in.
I never have a little response.
Excuse me. I take it back.
Well, Victor, this idea that, yes, indeed, the fossil fuel industry, if they could be stopped, but I believe that politically, we can't stop it as long as we believe in economic growth. And there hasn't been a politician yet who got elected who was for degrowth and who recognized if we all stopped buying fossil fuel and all the products made by it, all the plastics. But that isn't going to happen because we aren't going to stop buying. So who are we? I drove here in my car, and so I'm part of the problem. I can't blame the industry for providing me the car in the first place and the fuel in the second place. So unless I'm willing to stop driving, and I admit that I live at five Earths, and I know that that's ethically not right. I should live at less than one Earth. But indeed, my country gives me an overhead of two Earths before I even start with its military, industrial, governmental system. So my view is the good news, the really good news for me is that the collapse of our financial system is inevitable because of the debt crisis we're in, and the collapse of our industrial model is inevitable because we've run into the limits of natural resources. So with all of that collapse, I think more than actions right now to try to save that system would be to rethink how we're going to rebuild after the collapse. A lot of people will want to recreate what was lost, but we need to rethink a new framework for how our culture could live more like indigenous people, more at a subsistence level.
Well, I see a lot of that happening today with the transition towns movement and the more localization and to be resilient.
It's a start.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to give Claire an opportunity to tell us about Paris.
Well, there was just a meeting that I attended following the Bonn conference. There was a two-day organizing meeting in Paris called by the Coalition Climat 21. And I just do want to also comment on Bernie that, you know, I think it's a level. There are levels of individual responsibility, local responsibility and action, corporate challenge, which absolutely I agree with Victor that we have to be doing that, national action, international action. And we're working on all levels at the same time. And I do feel that some of the very best work that's going on all around the world, whether it's by women or men or together, indigenous peoples, local, is happening at local communities, especially given the lack of international agreement and action. And that's one thing that gives me a lot of hope. I'm a cautious optimist. I always have been, even though I certainly see collapse coming, the potential for that. But I also believe that humans get moving when their backs are against the wall. And one way they're getting moving is the mobilizing that's going on in Paris, which is really astonishing. The Coalition Climat 21 is a organizing body of many, many, many NGOs, non-governmental organizations based in France, and there were 400 people at this weekend gathering, 300 from France, 100 from 43 other countries. Myself and a couple other folks from the U.S. were there, and what they're planning is nothing short of astonishing. I'll just first report, during 2 weeks, and I apologize. Looks like, oh my God, the Sierra Club is trying to call me on my phone. Sorry for the beeps. It must be a fundraising call.
Well, we just hear silence, so if you could start from the beginning of the sentence.
Yes, okay. So in any case, there is a lot of organizing going on. There's going to be three or four major things happening in France and also around the world. Of the 400 people that were there, as I said, there were 300 from France. And one of the things that's happening is there's going to be two actions. One, usually in the past, there's been large demonstrations in the week in between the COP meetings. They're always 2 weeks long to do this negotiating. It takes 2 weeks every year for the final meeting. Many of the treaties are organized this way. But this year, there's going to be a major demonstration the day before it starts. It starts on November 30th for governments on Sunday, November 29th. There'll be a major demonstration in Paris, and then they'll probably be organizing for other demonstrations all over the world that same day. There also is planning a demonstration on the 12th, the day after it ends. It ends on Friday the 11th, and on Saturday the 12th, there'll be a second action that's already being planned to say what we liked, what we didn't like of what came out, and there's a lot of suggestions for what that action will be, and there's organizing meetings. It's very democratic. It's very open for how this is going to take place. Already 1,000 people are going to bicycle in from Belgium for both actions. There'll be thousands coming on trains and bicycles all over Europe and bus to join these actions. In the middle weekend of the the session in Paris, the entire village of Montreuil, which is just outside the city limits of Paris, has given over its city hall, its city plazas, theaters, movie theaters, libraries, for a giant global alternative solutions fair. And this fair is going to inviting people from all over the world to set up workshops, to do actions, to do all kinds of demonstrations of things that can work, of the kind of local resilience and local organizing that is going to take needed to implement success at the local level for however we're progressing in the future. And that, so there'll be, that's going to be a showcase that'll go on all weekend. And then during the entire conference, there'll be a blogging space for social media, so there'll be lots of social media coming out of the conference, as well as the final week. There's going to be a public NGO space where people can have nightly People's General Assemblies. There'll also be report backs from the official meeting on a nightly basis, and there will be different kinds of spaces for groups to organize daily demonstrations, daily actions coming out of the negotiations. Now, having said all this, as I mentioned earlier, there's a big focus on local actions on the last weekend of September, that there's a call for that. And I know, obviously here in the U.S. and around the world, there's other groups like Flood the System. There's our call, the Women's Global Call for Climate Justice, that will be doing more than a single action that weekend of September, but there'll be lots and lots of calls for support actions that will be going on this entire time. So rather than, of course, the Europeans will be largely focused on mobilizing towards Paris, but local actions around the world and support actions are really very important as well.
Great. So we have so many actions to list. It's hard to keep track of them. And we will be segueing shortly into a climate calendar of actions around the Bay Area. But I want Claire and Victor, I want to ask you both to think about the websites that you want to refer people to for more information so they can follow up on these actions, because we are getting to closing up the show. But Bing had one more comment or question.
Yes, and it just flew out of my mind.
Okay.
Let me go back. I want to just give Victor a final words and the website we should follow up on.
Well, thanks, Bing. International Forum on Globalization is ifg.org, and you can find a lot of stuff up there right now, sort of pathway to Paris, and we're really trying to emphasize the victims from the global south who are already feeling the impacts of climate catastrophes. And you'll see from some of IFG's board members' countries, in India, the triple tsunami that hit the Himalayas with the glaciers melting and disastrous impacts and reporting you'll find there, as well as from the Philippines, who've been hit by a series of super typhoons during the last two COPs, the Conference of the Parties in December, and certainly others expected to come. So we really want people to see, who's paying the price of these things, of U.S. inaction, and then also a lot of resources pointing to efforts to build power against those who are stopping the solutions that we know are possible. So you could check the ifg.org website. We'll have links to other websites there. But I think the 350.org and the Sierra Club and the Rising Tide and Credo and Rainforest Action Network can all give you a lot of, those are all great websites, I think, of groups who are going to be planning actions and possibly going to be in Paris trying to have impact. So that'd be the list I'd look at.
Thank you. That was a very ecumenical list. And to remind listeners, Victor also mentioned their report on the Koch brothers' role in climate finance, and that is also on your website, right?
It is. You'll see their assets up in Alberta, the tar sands, being more than anybody, more than Exxon, Chevron, Conoco, and also they're outspending all big oil to elect these extremists that we've got in office today. So that's where we want the political pressure to be focused, and we've got to get new leadership. What the criticisms before about Congress are all totally right on, but I guess for folks who also see the need to engage politically and to bring the grassroots power that we know is in the transition movement, and another similar movements across the country, across the world, that are taking off. It's the coming together, the convergence of these different movements that we've got to somehow translate into pragmatic political power quickly. I'm prepared for the disaster as well, but I guess in the meantime, I'm trying to figure out where we can have the most strategic pressure. And it seems to me there are just a few folks blocking these days. Every day you see more and more people coming on board, moving their money, divesting, disconnecting from the fossil fuels economy. And I see a lot of the alternatives out there, but it's a very powerful but isolated opposition that I think we've got to figure out a way to overcome.
Okay, great. Thank you. So what I'm going to do now is read what I have for a climate action calendar. And when I'm done, I'm going to ask you both to add any action items, events coming up, as well as your own websites. Victor, you've done that, but Claire, we'll turn to you as well. So
fantastic.
The first item I have is actually to ask you both. I know there's been a planning process mostly at the California Nurses Association through June, and was there just a meeting for Bay Area planning around Paris in July? Do you know?
Yes, there was. It was last week, and I...
Briefly.
I was unable to go. It was a gathering of groups that were involved in doing the action last year, the local action around the People's Climate March.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually found a website that I'll send to you, Karen, that you can post on the KWMR website if folks want to sign up and be involved in that planning process. I'm also going to be organizing a Road to Paris meeting for those who are actually going to be going to Paris and participating in policy sometime in either in August or September. And when we get around to doing that, we'll make sure and let you know so we can, and probably a public event as well.
But great.
So that's my report back on that.
Thank you. And then, Victor, you mentioned Conoco, and I want listeners to know that the last of the refinery healing walks is happening next, I think it's Sunday, the July 19th. It's at 8 a.m. The walk starts at 9:30. It's the Rodeo to Richmond Refinery Corridor Healing Walk. We have five refineries in the Bay Area, not just Chevron in Richmond, but also Tesoro and Shell in Martinez, Valero in Benicia, ConocoPhillips 66 in Rodeo, and then there's a proposed Westpac oil terminal in Pittsburgh. So this is a great place to connect with other activists and get plugged in locally if you haven't been. The website for that is refineryhealingwalks.com, and again, it's on July 19th. And then, Claire, chime in after this. WECAN, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network International, is holding a national organizing call tomorrow. This is Women's Climate Action, and you're invited to join. I'm going to list the phone number. It's at 11 a.m. Pacific. It's 1-877-724-3611, and the meeting ID is 230-358. I'm not going to repeat those. You should listen to our stream, listen to our archive after the show to get those again. But that's, again, the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network. Conference call tomorrow at 11 a.m. Also, you could contact Emily at wecaninternational.org for questions. Claire, is that the same conference call you're doing?
No, that's... The WECAN is doing their own International Day of Action on September 29th, around the same time as the UN General Assembly, similar to the one day of action they did last year. Although WECAN is one of the 15 to 20 and soon to be hundreds, we hope, women's organizations that are calling for the Women's Global Call for Climate Justice 6 months, 6 actions, 6 themes campaign. They're also doing their own action on September 29th, and that's an organizing call for that individual action. We encourage folks to do both. That's going to be a great action based out of New York and possibly in Paris as well. And then we'll have, but it's different than the local actions that we're doing that Osri is also part of in her group. So there's lots going on. A couple websites that is it now a good time?
Yeah, we've got about 15 seconds.
Okay, so we're actually launching our campaign tomorrow and we're still voting on our website. So I can't give you the final website, but it'll be something like Women for Climate Justice or Women Climate Justice. So if you Google Women Climate Justice, Women for Climate Justice tomorrow, you will probably find it.
Okay, we got to go.
But other than that, wedo.org, womengenderclimate.org, both of those should also be able to lead you to that campaign, and we hope that everyone out there will join us. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Victor and Claire.
And thank you, Bernie, for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas? We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone.